Blog Talk Radio.
Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing this fine evening in Minnesota?
Well, it's hot and humid, and I understand I doubt if we'll get basically any calls. Everybody's down at the Beyonce and Easy concert, whereas the Juno was telling me that the tickets started, what, $300 or what?
Oh, they have the nosebleed seats for right under 100, and there's really not that many tickets close to the stage. But if you want a ticket in the back, right in front of the main floor, you're talking $300-$500. I mean, I respect Beyonce and Jay Z, but I'm not paying that kind of money. No.
Now,
not,
where are they
having
that? Kind of
way?
The Target Center.
The Target Center.
Yeah, the big Target Center. Okay. So they can probably pack in about, what, 11,000?
Yeah, easily. Buy a little bit more with all that extra seating they put up. They did a time-lapse video today of them setting it up, and it was just amazing how they flipped that from a basketball court to let me take that back, Mr. Edwards. It's at U.S. Bank Stadium. U.S. Bank, my bad. I'm looking at the time-lapse video now. And it's actually U.S. Bank Stadium, how they flipped that thing around for all these different events and stuff. But, you know, we down there, we spending our hard-earned money. Well, not me, but some being members of the black community. And we still got homeless school children. So.
Sure have. And, by the way, really didn't any black folks really work on that stadium. So if you had 20 white folks working down there, a workforce of 7,500, I remember how they touted that. But anyways, we talked about it over four-year period. No one was really interested, didn't bother them. So, enjoying themselves down there, man. This comes at a time when there's a lot of stress all across the country, man, and clearly a lot of stress here in the Twin Cities, a lot of stress in Minneapolis, but even more so stress in the city of St. Paul. Our sister city to the east, but we'll be touching on that. I understand you've got a piece, a 7-year African-American child shot and killed in some crossfire there in Baltimore, Maryland. Why don't you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, in Baltimore, Maryland, the 7-year-old girl died from her injuries being shot in a car sprayed by bullets by a drug deal gone bad in Baltimore. And the gentleman was upset. His name is Jamal. He just goes by Jamal. He doesn't have a last name on there. And he wants us to send condolences out to Taylor Hayes and the Taylor Hayes family. And he's just wondering, where are the protesters? Because in his video that he has on Facebook online right now, which is going viral, with over 4.5 million views, he's asking, where is Black Lives Matter? Where is the NAACP? And in the video, he gets pretty detailed. He's basically damning the whole system because he says that, if the police shoot one of us, we're out blocking freeways, shutting down stores, businesses, tearing up stuff. And he also goes on to say, shutting down the airport. He says it doesn't matter if the perp has had a gun or not. He says we're out there full force, protesting this white man shooting our black people. It doesn't don't care what the circumstance is. And because now this 7-year-old girl gets shot in a drug deal gone bad, and he said it's so quiet in Baltimore that they just go into their little festivals, little parties, ain't thinking about this girl or her family. And he just finds a lot of hypocrisy in that. And
it's sad.
Yeah. Really sad. A little 7-year-old girl, never go to prom, never go to college, and no one seems to give a damn. And that's unfortunate. really
yeah,
unfortunate.
Well, make sure
in 2018.
Text the brother, let him know that the Ronnie Johnny program out of Minneapolis certainly have called attention to it. All we can say is, you know, welcome to the club, because, man, we've got some stuff going on here. And actually, other than Billy Hughes, Native American member of the Lakota tribe of the Lakota Nation, other than the Native Americans and some of their white supporters, you know, everybody's been kind of quiet. And then we've had a very peculiar situation, which we'll be getting into tonight. We're going an hour and a half, I understand. Phone lines will be open. Maybe, you know, some folks may take a break away from the concert or whatever. But we have a peculiar situation where the only African-American activist that really went with the family, actually went to the crime site, was there early that Sunday morning, that his son, 25-year-old son, was the target of a assassination attempt at a small black church in one of the most, quote-unquote, pristine white area in the state of Minnesota. So we'll certainly be taking a look at that, and we'll be talking in terms of two telephone conversations with the father of the young man who has been wounded, who will go in for his third surgery at 7:30 tomorrow morning at the hospital in St. Paul, which is on a shutdown. But, what you know, this situation, I do have that
interview, Mr. Edwards. Yeah, I just wanted to let you know I do have that interview with the father, if we want to listen to it at some point. So,
the father of
the
young man you're talking about, Brother Thompson. You're talking about John Thompson, or are you talking about in Baltimore?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about here in St. Paul, the young man that was shot outside the church.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly, after we get through with the Baltimore thing, let's put that on, because this man that you're talking about is a longtime activist. I mean, he was involved in the 2015 shutdown of the 4th Precinct. Strong supporter of everything that, you know, all the players wanted to do. And we'll be talking tonight about who has not even been there at the hospital to put the arms around him, embrace him, and et cetera. But any more on that, on the Baltimore situation? Do they have any suspects, by the way? That's a question I normally ask.
Yes, and at this time there are no suspects. And the gentleman just sent me a link to his audio, and I'm going to try to upload it to Blog Talk Radio while we're talking, because it does take a few minutes from Baltimore. But no, there are no suspects, he said, at this time. And but he said, he did send me messages, make sure your listeners know that this little girl doesn't count. According to the NAACP, the National Urban League, and all these black agencies, including Black Lives Matter. So.
Wow, and that's some of the criticism that's emerged in both of our cities here, in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. They're kind of silent, but I can understand. I think I understand. I was lax myself to the extent that should have understood that we had, you know, Beyonce coming to town, you know what I mean, and Easy, and
oh yeah,
that would take priority over everything, and, you know, to heck with any and everybody. I mean, you know, it's not something that they want to talk about. I apologize to myself for being remiss. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Edwards, I want to ask you a question, because you're the historian. You've been around here so long. This is not the first time that these type of situations have been ignored by our leadership. Now, you and I always say we stay in our lane. We do radio broadcasts and news, and I'm not necessarily out at no crime scene ever, myself personally. But, I mean, if we go back to the young man that was tased to death on the sixth floor of the YMCA back in the early 2000s, Cornelius Smith, I want to say.
Cornelius Smith.
There was nothing. I mean, as far as from what I saw, newspaper, things like that, this movement. And, I mean, I hate to say this, Mr. Edwards, but I'm still asking you the question, but I hate to say this, is are some of these people just prefer media opportunities rather than real activism? And then again, I don't really know what real activism is, you know. I haven't seen it.
That's an interesting observation you made, because that ties in with something that I have been authorized to repeat by the father of DeMarco Thompson. That's interesting you said that, Mr. Allen, because there are other people now thinking along the same lines. If it isn't a photo op, people aren't, you know, really not concerned. By the way, all the way back to the Cornelius Smith, Mr. Allen and myself did go to the city civil rights department to try to get some movement on a civil rights complaint against the police and the death of young Mr. Smith. And in the hallway of the downtown Y, I see we're not supposed to talk about that. Ultimately, the family acquired a law firm. In fact, if I'm not mistaken on this one, the family actually resided in, I think it was Fort Wayne, Indiana. And ultimately, about a year and a half later, they finally got an attorney, and there was some kind of settlement, which you couldn't hardly find in the paper. But Mr. Allen and I were asked to leave the Civil Rights Department when we came in to remember that, Don? Yeah, we were asked. Current Civil Rights Director, Ms. Velma Corville, that we were creating a disturbance. All we did was came in and said we wanted to see an investigator, and we wanted to try to do a citizen's action, if you will, which is allowed under the Civil Rights Ordinance of the City of Minneapolis, and we were told to depart, and the police would be called on us. Yeah, and ultimately the city settled in that particular matter of the death of that African there on the premises of the downtown, big powerful downtown YWCA. Yeah, we just don't talk about that. Just like we don't, you know, we talk about Terrence Franklin or stuff like that. We kind of get the signal that, you know, if it's not authorized by the boss, if you will. It's not something that we should be involved in. I mean, you know, should raise any questions. Yeah. Anybody wants to call it up can go to their website and call up Cornelius Smith.
Yeah. Cornelius Smith. And remember that, just to touch on this, because I remember that in detail, Ms. Edwards. Remember the first report the city pages ran that trying to help, help the police, and Cornelius Smith critical after his police encounter. But he was dead on a 6-4. And you remember I went down to the YMCA to try to talk to the executive director and got put out.
Right.
At the YMCA.
Right. Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is downtown Minneapolis. Cornelius Smith, tased to death in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
Are you calling it up there? I see you work on it there. Yeah.
September 9th, 2010. Yep.
2010.
Mentally ill. Yeah, he's a mentally ill 28-year-old who was acting bizarrely, they say.
Yeah.
That was the excuse written in the Star and Tribune. You know, he was just out there playing basketball. He was a member of the YMCA. Not like he was loitering, but still, getting back to our point, we had zero folks, except you and I, maybe a couple other people, that do broadcast talk about it, but there was no marching, no protests. I mean, people was living good. They might have had a Beyonce concert back then, you know.
In fact, two of the employees that were on site at the particular time that helped the civil rights director who was on the board at that time, you know, take a position to protect the city. Those two employees and Ms. Jung, Asian, and Miss Precious Ferguson, who is now the head of the Human Resources Department. They were well compensated. They were given jobs, big jobs with the city. Remember, they came over from the Y.
Exactly. That's the payoff, you know. That's right.
Yeah, Precious Ferguson and Destiny Young, who was just convicted of vehicular homicide on a gross misdemeanor and has, in fact, been demoted. But it's interesting that my colleague, Mr. Allen, brought that back into play because, boy, I can well remember we were told that we would be trespassed if we didn't get out of there, in there talking about that. And then, like I said, less than a year later, Ms. Ferguson, African-American, Ms. Jung, a Vietnamese, showed up and became very well healed and important and powerful employees for the city of Minneapolis. Their depositions, by the way, were rather critical to at least, you know, minimizing the amount of damages of Sea Daisy that the city of Minneapolis was supposed to pay. But, oh, you know, we're not supposed to talk about things like that. So I apologize, boss. I apologize. You know, we shouldn't know. Don the one brought it up. Don brought it up. We shouldn't even talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Blame it on me. Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting that this stuff happens. But, but you know, not to knock Miss Dr. Reverend Nakima Levy Armstrong, formerly Nakima Levy Pounds, but, you know, I don't know what the methodology is to even look at these things and decide who you do and who you don't do. And that's my confusion, because a black man running down the street with a weapon who had earlier fired shots in a residential neighborhood does not obey police commands. And I'm not by no means saying that it's okay. And the police kill him, then all of a sudden they want to use this person as the promotion person for police brutality, police violence. But if you notice, Mr. Edwards, the young man that got shot in front of the church, if you the 7-year-old girl in Baltimore who was gunned down in a drug deal gone bad, you haven't had any official statement. And it's really peculiar, because this political season, in Minnesota at least, I can speak on that because that's where I live, I haven't heard not even a senator or congressman or anybody that looks like us make a comment or a statement, I should say, about any of this. And it's awfully quiet.
Yeah, we have a sitting congressman, Keith Ellison, in fact, running for attorney general of our beloved state.
Yeah.
Now, he was on Nightline last night talking about stuff going on the Gaza Strip or something like that. But he doesn't talk about what's happening, because he still is the congressman for the 5th Congressional District here in Minnesota. I don't know, Don. I think it'll be kind of tough to get any calls tonight, because everybody's partying with Beyonce and et cetera at a time when there's a lot of tension. Oh, by the way, let me say the reason I'm saying that. We may get somebody that may call in and have the heart to support what we're saying, because it went video night before last. Do you know that Aryan Brotherhood neo-Nazi stormtroopers marched into the Rondo community the other night?
No, I didn't.
Board of those that protect and defend. Yeah, I know, because the media didn't deal with it, but there were some African Americans and some white technical people who posted the pictures of the neo-Nazis, about 30 strong. Now, this is in a town where in 2015, when we had people demonstrating at the 4th Precinct after the shooting death of Jamar Clark, that four Caucasians, some with affiliations with police in other jurisdictions, approached a group of African Americans there on Morgan Avenue and Plymouth, which is right next to the police station, opened fire and shot all 5 of them. And we talked and tried to prod our community on these programs for about 3 weeks. I didn't really have anything to say. Now, one of the whites did go to trial and basically received a very reduced sentence. In fact, his attorneys and his family were asking that, you know, he be given probation. I don't know many places in America openly that you have neo-Nazis gunned down 5 African-Americans 25 yards away from a police station. And I don't know. There was never any real disturbances or anything like that. Folks just said, well, they shouldn't have been there. Well, I'm not quite sure which ones they were talking about, but that happened here in our beloved city. That was in November of 2015. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Shot 5
that's,
Negroes.
That's just terrible.
Shot him down in the street. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of Jamar Clark, you know, we can never give the Reverend Jerry McAfee enough thanks for making sure that young man had a headstone. Out of all the media
that's
attention
correct.
That all these other, mm-hmm. after all the media attention that all these other people got for being, you know, was on the camera every day talking all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I know donations were being given to some of them. You know, it was Jerry Maxey and a contingency of preachers with Mr. Al Flowers and a couple other folks that made sure that
Lisa Clemens, right.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
Yes.
All
yes.
of them made
yes.
sure. And you know, if Black Lives Mattered, it should matter enough to give the boy a headstone. But it didn't.
Yeah.
And it,
yeah.
it
when I went up that particular year in 2016, in April of 2016, because actually his headstone is not far away from the headstone of one of my grandfathers, C.M. Edwards.
Okay.
Headstone's right there for anybody to think we're doing fake news. And there was a sister working at that time at Crystal Lake Cemetery, and she made sure that she identified, and I went out and took a look at the site with my own eyes, and there was the headstone as was promised, and I think that's just decent that you would remember that and would call their names out, because if it had not been for the Reverend Jerry McAfee and the others that you just previously mentioned, Jamar Clark would have no headstone. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be one of the invisible people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they, you know, Mr. Edwards, out at the cemetery where my mother is buried on Dale Street between Maryland and Lavender there, Roselawn, there are a lot of Black men that were gunned down over the last 5-6 years in St. Paul that just have these little, like, styrofoam markers. There's no headstone there.
Yeah.
You know?
There's nothing there.
So, I mean, it's ridiculous. And I don't know how to solve these problems or this situation. It seems like an opportunity for someone to walk in. Now we have all that recast money distributed to all these folks. And, I mean, I'm happy for them, but, Mr. Edwards, let's keep it real. You can't do nothing with no $2,500, okay? I got a wife that will spend $2,500 in 6 hours, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, I mean, really, I'm looking at the specificity of detail that these people are supposed to do in the month of August, September, whenever it's over with. And I'm just like, okay, what's going to happen? What's the promotion mechanism? How do you reach these people? And I'm like,
well, you read us a list a couple programs ago. You read a list of some of the organizations that had been the recipients. Actually, the amount of money that's still going to be available is $3.4 million, $1.6 from 2017 and the remainder of 2018, and then that would make an additional $3 million would be available. So because the grant was actually, and in fact, I need to be with absolute clarity and specificity. The actual amount was $7,400,000 because there was $2.4 million that came from the Bloomberg Foundation in New York City.
Well,
where that money's at, man, I don't, you read the list.
I read the list, Mr. Edwards, but I'm looking here, and 3,100 people approximately voted. And I'm looking through here, and young parents facing homelessness. Mr. Edwards, please, work with me on this real quick, because if you don't see the irony in this, and our listeners need to see the irony and crazy and hypocrisy in this, okay? Young parents facing homelessness. Now, if I was a philanthropic agency, I would say, okay, problem, okay? We might have to throw maybe $1.5 million out there just to put a dent in it, okay, just to put a dent in it. Because you don't want to treat these people like lab experiments in a Petri dish and go and talk to them. So I'm looking at this thing. I got the list where everybody who got money is right here in front of me in the studio. Okay, I'm going to put it on screen for you if that was here. And young parents facing homelessness, project team, Latunji Abram, Professor Emeritus Sandra McNeil. Description, conduct training for parents that encourage, inspires parents to become increasingly engaged in their children's IEPs. What? Provide a list of resources assisting parents with elementary and high school age family youth. What? Okay, I can't read no more because I'm about to curse, okay? $2,250. Again, let me repeat that. Parents Facing Homeless got a grant for $2,250. What can you do with $2,250 for parents facing, young parents facing? I mean, it's
from,
cool. I
from a grant, from a grant that is totally available at $1.6 million. Wow. Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm just
we asked that question 3 weeks
here,
ago. We've got no response.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna look at another one. I'm gonna look at another one here that's gonna get you goat here. Let me just keep going down. I was looking at these earlier, Mr. Edwards, just the $2,500 grant, $2,200 grants, and I got pretty much disgusted because I know that someone that looks at systems as you do, that this is enough. Okay, here we go. Here we go. How's this one? I'm gonna leave them alone right now because I'm going to leave them alone because I don't got on them so bad they upset with me. Now, Jihad Muhammad, Minnesota Fight Club. Minnesota Fight Club aims to reduce trauma for inner-city gun violence by providing a boxing, inspiring. And this is Target Fight. Minnesota Fight Club target audience are youth 12, 25 years old living in the inner city. They gave them $25,000. Jihad Muhammad, Minnesota Fight Club, $25,000. Okay, I'm cool.
And where do they operate out of? Where Phyllis Wheatley?
It doesn't
where,
say.
What?
No, it doesn't say. It doesn't give that much specificity. No, it doesn't. And I'm cool with that. That's $25,000. You could probably get maybe 10 or 15 youth and get them activated. You know, you got to give them some incentives, some target cards, some cash. That's cool. Here we go. Here, let me just. I got a juicy one here. Let me just find it here. Now, the funny part of this grant package is that everybody jumped on board, even agencies from the state and the city. Check this out. Community-based birth trauma response team for families affected by incarceration. The project team is state and local adult juvenile correction facility, Department of Pediatrics, University of Minnesota, and culturally specific reproductive health care providers, $25,000. So they got doula support, offers holistic experience, providing informational health support, emotional support via the opportunity to practice and trust, experience safety and physical support during a labor. Okay, I'm gonna let that go before I start snapping again. Oh, and here goes another one. $15,000. Unfit for human consumption. Healing the trauma of mass incarceration. Team project. Vina K and the team includes two men who were recently released from prison that were partners while in prison. Two family members of incarcerated people. And so, I mean, Yamanji Pace, and the Minnesota Department of Health. So the state agencies, they got their hands into this. Consulting is some of these folks, and I mean, for full disclosure, I have relatives on here. Like We Win, Marquise Armstrong and Jesse Buckner. Now, Marquise Armstrong might be the husband of Nakima Levy Pound Armstrong. Yeah, am I correct?
He is. He is.
Okay.
He is.
Well, they were awarded $15,000 from Recast Resiliency Fund, 365 Fund.
Yep. How much?
Holding 8 2-hour circle sessions over the course of 3 months. Each session will address the different subjects in the area of understanding your environment, express trauma, dealing with emotions, leadership, planning for the future. I mean, obviously, no background checks were done here. Oop, and just let me shut up. The one that I agree with the most here is Devon Nolan, who has been doing this food and this healthcare thing for like many years with just putting her pennies together. I know Mr. Nolan, his granddaughter is Devon Nolan. They gave her they didn't give her because they got an invoice, $24,995. I like that one. This project will serve African American youth in North Minneapolis. That was a good call, as far as I'm concerned. That was a good call. Let me see here. Sebastian Community Center, $22,250. Project team, Kevin Sanders, certified forklift instructor. Pat Anderson, 20 years experience providing service to underserved population. Cheryl Childs, the program evaluation for Sabathamy. And so they're going to, our target audience, 15 men of color on probation or recently out of, just got out of jail. The funny thing about all these grants, Mr. Edwards, and wrapping this up to move on because I don't want to start cursing again or at all on our show, is that at no time do any of these grants deal with the young undergrads in these different universities that can use some help, that can use some tutoring, that can use some financial aid assistance, that can use some mentoring. None of this. It seems like they go for the people either getting out of jail or the unemployed people. Because I'm going to tell you, the educated, the people in school, they're not going to tolerate no BS. But so we totally missed that. That's where the blind spot is on this whole award. Hey, Ms. Edwards, we have a call I think we need to take.
Sure, go ahead.
Caller, go ahead. You're live on the air with the Ron and Don Show. What's your name?
My name is Doug Mann. I'm a school board candidate, of course.
Doug,
that's
how
right.
you doing? I haven't heard from you in a long time. How you doing, Doug? What's on your mind?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I'm running for the school board, and I'm addressing some policy issues that other candidates will not touch with a 10-foot barge pole. Back in February, the district did a report on retention of black teachers, and carefully cherry picked the data, saying that the retention rates annual basis for all black teachers in the schools were 88%, and for white teachers it was 92%, and that is not a big difference, right? And all the school board members were nodding their heads in agreement, and I was really fit to be tied, but I stayed quiet. What that means is your non-retention rate is 8% for white teachers and 12% for black teachers and that or teachers of color, and that's like a 50% difference. I think that's pretty significant, and it has to do with personnel policies that also victimize children of color who are heavily exposed to inexperienced and newly hired teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And, part of the reason we have a different, the state law has, from the beginning, has limited rights of teachers in the big cities. Originally, probationary status only applied to the big city schools back in 1926 up until more recently. But the thing is, the district, supposedly the question of whether to retain or non-retain teachers on probationary status based on competency is supposed to be done through a peer review process. And that's what's done in, say, suburban schools, which have low turnover. But in Minneapolis public schools, you're not only doing that, but teachers who would be allowed to continue on are just being laid off and replaced. So
Mr. Allen and I both understand that well, because Mr. Allen has been getting that same kind of information out to Mr. Mann going back to the last time that we got a call from you about 3 years ago.
Mr. Allen has
said that there seems to be a significant absence of anybody being concerned. Now, let me just say this, Doug. Have you had any debates? Have you been to any debates? And have you brought this forward in any of the debates with the other folks that are running for the school board? How many people are running for the school board this time, and what areas are they from?
Okay. The only contested race is the at-large. There are two at-large positions, and there have been no debates sponsored at all.
And
very little news coverage. The DFL has a full slate. There is going to be some – there are people unhappy with the choice of a slate. I think Rebecca Gagnon is – you know, is running without the endorsement. So that should draw a lot of people into, you know, into the race. But
okay.
As far as
Mr. Allen, you have any questions of Mr. Mann? Because we appreciate what Mr. Mann is saying, but these are things that we've been talking about 4, 5, 6, 7 years. I'm a little surprised to hear that we're here in August.
Yeah,
significant debate. Go ahead, Don.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, but we might have to do it like we did before. My thing is like, Mr. Mann, I read all your stuff about schools and how they should function. The thing is, you have to look at the pipeline also. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I went to 2 master's programs or 3 or 2 at Hamline as the only black American male. I mean, there wasn't even an East African in any of my classes or any of them programs. And when you get into the district, I'm in St. Paul. I'm licensed. I'm also licensed to teach with special permissions, as you know, physics, economics, social studies, as well as my original license, 5 through 12, communications arts, which is basically an English teacher. And so if you look at the pipeline, there are very few black male teachers out there. And when you say that, like you made a statement about new and experienced teachers, we have to start somewhere. When I started, I was a new and experienced teacher in education. But I was also a black male older than the 22, 23, 24-year-old white women that were getting hired on a regular basis. But I had a gift because the kids looked like me, and I was the only black teacher in the school. So I had zero behavior problems, 100% learning. The engagement was off the hook. But the thing is, if we don't hold the teacher training universities accountable, from Hamline to St. Thomas, St. Kate, St. Mary's, all the saints out there, and the University of Minnesota, you get this slice of white bread. There are schools with no black professors, male or otherwise, doing teacher training programs. Okay? I questioned a professor at St. Thomas where I'm working on my PhD right now, and she got so upset that the chair asked me to withdraw from the class. And I'm saying, no, it ain't going to happen like that because you're going to be on the news. I'm telling WCCO right away, okay? Because you can't have these 65, 70-year-old professors who make these students do busy work try to explain our kids to these new teachers because they don't have the damnest clue at all whatsoever. So if you're looking at education in the big picture, I hope you get in. I hope you win this time. Because you would actually affect change inside that school district in Minneapolis. Thing is, we have to look at the teacher training programs. I went to St. Thomas, and I'm telling you, if they hadn't hired this latest black professor to be my advisor and a teacher for my my EDD PhD class, or I would have just went back to Hamline. Because Hamline's just as white as St. Thomas. And
well, yeah,
it's a problem. It's a big problem. But go ahead, your comments, please.
Yeah, it was several years ago. I ran into some black graduates of a teacher training at St. Thomas, actually, and you know they were staying in touch with each other and sharing notes on and. You know, they were all applying to the Minneapolis school districts and couldn't get an interview. Now, in the last few years, I guess the district has been hiring something like 30% of their new hires are teachers of color, not necessarily black teachers. And then and a lot of the district's teaching force, of color, has been hired just in the last few years. I don't know. Prior to that, it might have been around 10%. Now it's about 16%. And they were talking about if they continued hiring 29% teachers of colors every year for the next 10 years, they would raise the proportion of teachers of color in the school district from 16% to 19%. And the HR rep that was giving the presentation said that that's really good. You know, they're doing a really good job, and that's, you know,
oh, wow.
And, you know, how, and there was no voice of dissent from anybody on the school board. You know, that's terrible. It's, you know, it's if you're hiring teachers of color and but you're not retaining them, you're giving preferential retention of white teachers. And I think that's been the problem all along. The absolute number of African American teachers in the United States has declined from 1970. You know,
well, yeah, it's down around less than 2%. But if you look at this, like on the East Coast in Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland, Washington D.C., you have teachers of color, black teachers in a total black town, basically walking off the job. And it's ridiculous. And so you have even less than 2% nationally. Here, it's even worse. I mean, the portfolio process, the licensing process. And we can't.
But
let me ask this question.
Let me ask, we've been down this road. Doug, are you at some point in a position to maybe join with someone like Mr. Allen and file a suit in the federal courts? Are you prepared to do that?
I'd be happy to get together with him and talk about that.
Oh, okay.
See,
that's an approach because we can only talk for so long to the extent of what's going on when it's already known. It's different when you decide to challenge him in the courts. That's what kind of gets the attention. But we've got some calls. I'm getting a text message that Mr. Alfred Flowers has been trying to get through. So I'm not sure. What calls do we have holding, Don?
We have none holding right now. We have zero calls holding.
Okay.
But our number is 347-426.
Maybe Mr. Flowers. All right. Well, Doug, we appreciate the opportunity to kind of give you a chance to advance and discuss your candidacy again, and wish you the best. You know, try to get back to us in October, just before the November election. Let us know how you're doing, what kind of momentum you've got.
Oh, and as far as, you know, I'd like to discuss with both of you, you know, getting some legal action. I'm thinking along the lines of suing Minnesota and the state courts for discriminatory practices, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, all right, that's something to take a look at, and we've been talking about that for years. Every once in a while, you see, the last time that it happened was under the NAACP of Minneapolis and Curtis Shivers. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I was part of that,
40
too.
Years ago. Yeah. Okay, thank you, Doug. Take care. All right.
You bet.
Yeah, wow. Well, you know, Doug kind of got his thing in on his candidacy. Of course, now we're caught in a situation where if somebody else is running, they call in. Let me do this, and that you say we don't have any calls, because I've made a commitment to a number of people in four different situations, Don. Number one, our prayers go out to former Regent Josie Johnson, who was seriously injured by a Uber driver about 6 days ago, threw her from the car, injuring her, and et cetera. She was on KMOJ on Sunday being asked by another program person, another program that came on. But we just want to send her our condolences and best wishes, recovery, and we hope that charges are filed against the Uber driver, again, a black African, if you will. I'm just not understanding what he's doing. Secondly, we want to send out our condolences to the family of Mr. Hughes, William Billy Hughes of St. Paul, 905 St. Anthony, shot and killed by St. Paul police officers on early Sunday morning around 2:30. Native American community really seems to be moving in dealing with that. And then we want to send our condolences and our prayers out to John Thompson, long an activist here in the city of Minneapolis, worked both sides of the river. You may not always agree with him, but he's out there, he's fighting, he's at the scene, and et cetera. And it was peculiar that Mr. Thompson was the only really activist who showed up at the Native American shooting. And then 2 days later, his son was gunned down. DeMarc Thompson was gunned down in front of a small African-American or multiracial church on the corner of Grotto and Summit, which, if you know that area, you know, contains some of the wealthiest Minnesotans, as well as the mansion and estate of our current governor. The governor's mansion is located in that vicinity. And so it's just important that we indicate on behalf of a community our prayers to these individuals. Also, let me say this, that in the case of Mr. Thompson, who has been treated very poorly by the St. Paul Police Department, we had two discussions with him today. The St. Paul Police, now you have to understand, his son is under heavy anesthetic, et cetera. They will operate on him 7:30 tomorrow, the second or third operation. He is probably partially paralyzed. But the St. Paul Police Department has told him, very puzzling to me, that they will not do anything about the case until he gives them a statement, which does sense when they have the name of the perpetrator, who appears also to be a police informant, as well as the license number of the car being driven by one of his associates. So I just feel compelled that that information get out. We would hope that quickly in the case of Mr. Hughes that, you know, Mayor Melvin Carter will get that video out and the 911 calls and all of those things to make a determination so that the Ramsey County Attorney can decide after the investigation by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension if they intend to initiate any charges. By the way, one of the officers, Officer Matthew Jones, is a mixed-race individual. His father was shot and killed, who was also a police officer, Tim Jones, was shot and killed in 1994 by a white supremacist. He and another officer by the name of Ryan, who was killed earlier in the day, one of the darkest days for law enforcement in the city of St. Paul. But one of the officers is a mixed race, African American, if you will. Officer Vincent Adams, I assume he's Caucasian, though the BCA and others have stayed away from it. So want to bring that forward, if you will, to our listening audience, the situation. And there's just great mystery with regards to what really precipitated the assassination attempt against DeMarco Thompson, the 25-year-old son of John Thompson. People are saying that we shouldn't talk about these kinds of things. We should keep quiet. You know, it takes us all the way back to the brother in the YWCA. You know, clearly I don't agree with it. I don't think you do either. But we put it out there, and we hope for the best in all these situations. Former Regent Josie Johnson beaten by a Uber driver, a man who happens to be a black African in this country. By the grace of God and through the efforts of people such as Dr. Josie Johnson, we have Mr. Thompson, we have, of course, Mr. Hughes, who is deceased, if you will. Also, by the way, on behalf of our many, many friends in the Twin Cities, we share the sorrow of the death of the first African-American hired by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department some 37 years ago, if you will, and that was the beloved Art Blakely. And I'm being told, Mr. Allen, that it appears that his funeral will be at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds. You still there?
Sir, I am here. We had a couple people in the queue who tapped my shoulder that they was waiting. So I said, we'll get right to you.
Well, let's get them on. I said, we want to get that out. We got plenty of time. We're going for an hour and a half tonight. We got plenty of time. Let's get them on, Don. Let's get them on.
Oh, we're good. Hey, caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead. What's your name? Do we know you? Are you a friend of the show? Hello.
Gentlemen, am I on the air?
You are on the air, sir. I knew that was you. Hey, Em, how you doing? Welcome.
Very good, very good. Sorry I couldn't call in earlier. I didn't hear some of the earlier, so I'm sure you've been talking about the state of affairs in the Twin Cities. I guess my comment, especially on the Blevins issue, because I grew up with the family. you know, as Ron, you know, as I saw on his show, the great tribute he gave to the family, talking about their membership, Bethesda Baptist Church, where, you know, I attended, and my mother was the pianist there for, well, her whole life. And, you know, it's so distressing, you know, to look at that video, and I'm sure you guys have talked about that, but the thing that really gets me is that, you know, we really need to have a change. And I think that things really aren't going to change until people can look at that video and videos like that and be able to say, that's not right. You know, this is not how we want to conduct our business. This is not how we want to, you know, sheriff our town. And until people are willing to step up and say what they see in these videos, that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of condoning, instead of congratulating, you know, the union comes out and says they need to get an award. They need to be just, you know, for chasing a man down. I don't know. I'm really perplexed by where we're at now. And I want to have hope, but I think until people can really look at what they're seeing and be outraged by it, I don't know how things are going to change. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't know. Don, go ahead, and I'll touch on some of the inside stuff that, because that's, you know, excellent point being made by him.
Yes.
Any observation by you, Don? Go ahead, and I'll follow.
Well, I'm just watching. I don't know what's going to happen. Who's going to step up, step back, step sideways, and just do the right thing. But, you know, it's interesting, as you say. I mean, the whole concept, the system that's turning to the black community. And you're wondering, when is it going to rise? When is it going to get better? And so that's where I remain, kind of the area I'm remaining in. Mr. Edwards?
Well, I'm certainly saddened because, as we said the last time that we were on live ago, and M called in and basically said some of
yeah.
the same reflections. And, of course, you can kind of enhance them a little bit now because, you know, little pieces of information come out. Example, allegedly a shell casing from the gun that allegedly Mr. Blevins had found a half a block away or something like that. The shell casing, of course, they said the shell casing had his DNA on it. I guess so. You know, the coroner had his body. The family did have that was a mistake as far as I'm concerned, a white undertaker.
Yeah.
Provide and prepare the body, so you had that. The fact of what the Federation president said, you have to remember it basically what 32, 33 days passed from the events of the 23rd of June to August 1. When the announcement was made, but let's remember this, and I think we touched on it a little bit the last time you called in and you were with him, that the video politically was not driven by anything that the mayor did, the BCA did, or anybody else. It was driven by a private video that was played 3 days before on a Thursday evening by KSTP at approximately 10:01 p.m., Central Daylight Saving Time. It was a video from a camera on the side of a house of a private resident whose the camera was facing the alley. KSTP did not show the actual shooting. They blurred it in, if you will, but the voices and et cetera were well heard, well reflected. I think the officer identified as the lead officer, if you will. I think he must have used the word "if," you know, and I have to use it this one time because we try to stay away from it here. Stop, I'll fucking shoot you. Showed me an officer that was extremely angry, if you will, and then his partner was
yes.
equally angry. But
yeah.
his partner was quite some ways behind him, but who actually violated the police department policy because his partner, Kelly, actually fired from behind and actually across his partner, which is something that you're not supposed to do, if you will. I assume the Internal Affairs unit of the Indianapolis Police Department will, you know, recommend some letter of reprimand or something. I'm not sure. But just a lot of mysterious things, such as there's a lot of talk within the Minneapolis Fire Department, which were the first responding emergency unit. We did not talk about this much the last time you were with us a couple weeks ago, Em, is that the cops actually stood there and allowed him to bleed out. So he may not have survived, not with four bullets in him, but it depended on location because all of them were in his back. And, of course, for 30-some days, the coroner made sure that he never provided that information. Then you had the situation where the person that had been retained, him by the Moore family that you're talking about, that y'all attended Bethesda, that Judge Hatcher, nobody's talking about that since it happened. We talked about it on this program last Wednesday. Judge Hatcher pulled out, quit. Right after reviewing the film at a location of the Minneapolis Police Department's Special Operations Unit, and et cetera. And I never could quite understand why Judge Hatcher did that. I mean, Judge Hatcher had a very successful relationship here along with the attorney, Robert Bennett. But what nobody's talking about, because Bennett is suing the city for $50 million in the case of Justine, Bennett said he really didn't have any time, and see, Judge Hatcher does not have a license to practice law in the state of Minnesota. That's why Robert Bennett was brought in during the Castile situation and split that $1 million in attorney's fees between him and Judge Hatcher, and she went on about her business. A lot of peculiarities, if you will, that people don't seem to want to explain, but quickly people have dismissed it. I don't know how many people I've heard say, well, you know, the brother brought it on himself. He shouldn't have had a gun. And I'm like, wow. Because I'm not sure, Em, that the photographs and pictures that we saw were absolutely absolute, that was a gun. And I take
well,
it
let's
back
talk
this,
about that. Not, let's talk about that. You know, let's talk about this issue of the gun and Mr. Blevins firing shots. Now, a shot or I'm not going to say shots. I don't know if that's correct or not.
No, yeah, you need to correct stuff because they said a shot. Yeah.
But I mean, that didn't come out. That didn't come out until the video came out. He had fired a shot. You know, I mean,
a shot.
He had a gun, and all of this stuff has been, you know, all of a sudden it comes out after the video comes out. But again, and then the links that they went through to explain how they doctored the video and altered it and sent it to somewhere out in a different part of the country, and they altered it.
Los Angeles, California.
And you could see the film jumping around and stopping and hooping and hopping. And, you know, I guess I just don't buy it. You know, I mean, I guess especially with the haste. You know, the haste that the county attorney came out and just said, oh, yep, this is it. We're not going to charge anybody. He had a gun. He shot the gun. But that all didn't come out until the press
30 days
count.
Later, yeah. 30
until,
days.
Until later. So it's hard to believe, you know, and I'm just going by what I'm seeing, the sequence of events, the sequence and the timing of when these things come out. It just makes it so implausible to believe their story, but they see it as an open and shut, and that gets back to my original point that, you know, things aren't going to change until we all can see the same thing, and then we need to see the same thing when human beings are involved. I mean, if a human being's involved, this is what we need to look at.
Him?
I agree.
I just think that the whole, it just seems implausible, but from what I'm seeing, it looks like it's over. I mean, it looks like the investigation, it looks like the they have pretty much tried to just squash, this is an open and done deal, he had a gun, And then they don't talk about, they said the call was somebody was shooting a gun somewhere in North Minneapolis. Well, was that the same location where they saw him? Was it, I mean, maybe Mr. Edwards, you have more information to put this timeline.
It was the same location within a couple blocks. I mean, but, you know, I talked about that on my on my television program and et cetera. You know, I'm like everybody else. I'm just the sad by the dismissal of the death of Blevin. The quickness in which the county attorney moved. In fact, let me just say this. In the question is being brought up, we're talking about it. We've got more than enough time. I found it fascinating that there was really no reflections by the white media or any of our African-American leadership about the fact that all of this was driven by the private video that was paid for clearly by KSTP and that was dropped on the public that Thursday night. That's what made the mayor and the DCA and everybody else, because they were ticked about that. They were absolutely ticked. The other thing is, and I repeat what I said a couple weeks ago, when you listen to the body cam of the officers as they were approaching the corner where Mr. Blevins was sitting down, and I remember initially the media jumped on that, and then that lasted maybe 24 hours. When you see him get up from his sitting on the sidewalk, when you see him get up, initially what all the stations said, you can see the gun in his right pocket. When the so-called final picture of him allegedly at shooting backwards, if you will, putting the gun under his left arm and firing back at one of the officers, the gun allegedly was coming out of that pocket, which would have been his left pocket. So my question was, in that short chase, which took about, 27, 28 seconds, because they were running at a pretty good, foot speed, I'm trying to figure out where was the movement by Mr. Blevins in pulling the gun from his right pocket over to his left pocket, and then as they got up in the far end of the alley in the final seconds of his life, he was able to reach across his body and fire the gun back. Both officers told the same story. I feared for my life, so I'm not understanding which officer was Mr. Blevins allegedly aiming at. But we all were looking at the camera. The one thing you would see, particularly from an automatic pistol, is that you would see something called, and Mr. Allen, you're a military person. I'm a member of the National Rifle Association. The one thing that you always see is a flash. You would see a flash. Yeah. And I'm like him. We sent it out to Hollywood to one of the best studios, forensic studios in the world, and they allegedly looked at it, and et cetera. And as you said, the picture was jumping, the film was jumping, things like that. But the thing I kept asking, where was the flash? Where was the flash? Now, the cartilage, the shell casing, was clearly not found in close proximity to where Mr. Blevins fell. But you are correct, Jim. The matter is criminally closed.
Yeah.
Absolutely close. Yeah.
Yeah, and if he shot the gun, when did he shoot the gun?
Oh, he shot the gun. He would have had to shot the gun according to the narrative that they've given us. When you saw the last frame of him just as the officer was shooting him in the back and his hand, remember what they said now, you'd have to be a hell of a contortionist to be able to have had the gun in your left hand and some way or another bring it back and shoot it. So if you remember, you go back, take a look at those pictures, you will see that they said, he had his arm across his body and fired backwards at the officer. In fact, they went on to say that, you could tell because he was looking back, and this was both of the police officers, if you will. They said that he was looking back to spot where we were so that he could stop and target us. In fact, he was leading us into an ambush. I mean, those are the statements that were made, and that's what the county attorney predicated his decision on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these are all secondary, almost anecdotal type statements. And it just, you know, defies the reality of what we saw in this film, where these officers got out of that car and the chase was on. And plus, now the young lady that was in the original video with a child, I mean, has she been identified? I mean, I've seen some accounts.
She gave a statement that night, Jim. They
so
took
is
her
that
down
the
to
one
that she gave a statement. She's the mother of these children.
Is
but
she the
I,
one that
I
they
said,
put in the car? Is that the one? She's the one they put in the car?
Yeah. Her and the baby. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
her.
What I said to
but did she say he had a gun? Did they ask her that?
Yes, and she did say he had a gun. She did say he had a gun. In fact, that was a part of her testimony before the Minneapolis City Council a week later. Yeah. Yeah, but it still does not match up with what later became the narrative.
No.
Yeah, because see, I have to say this to you guys. You know, I wrote it in one of my columns a couple of weeks before they made the move that the psychological testing and profiling of the two officers needed to have been examined. One came on in 2013, the other one in 2014. See, I keep saying to you guys, what happened, and if you listen closely to them, in that particular scene where they are approaching the corner, they are identifying what they say is the person that had been called in as firing a weapon. If you listen closely to the amplification and the pitch of their voice and et cetera, you can hear the anxiety and the anger. And the reason was, gentlemen, and I said this to Ms. Allen, I said this on the programs over the last 3 weeks, they thought that this black man was holding a white woman and what they thought to be a white child hostage. I told y'all that 3 weeks ago. They thought that he was holding her hostage. And the full flavor of their anger came into play and was driven by that chase. Also, gentlemen, I said to you the last time you were on, yeah, you know, I assume that both of those officers have been sent back to desk duty and will not be allowed to come on the street until they go back to the shooting range, because none of us, well, none of y'all have paid any attention. They fired 14 times. They hit him 4 times. And that they missed him 10 times. That level of proficiency and marksmanship, you're no dime in the Army. That gets you sent back to the barracks, buddy.
Yeah.
And no one talks about that. No one talks, except on this program right now tonight, you know. And it fascinated me because it's one of the reasons that the medical examiner took all of that time and never did indicate how many times that Mr. Blevins had actually been hit. Now, they made him admit they had to because the CSI people, the crime scene investigator, had taken pictures of all those placards that you put down when you find shell casings, and it was quite clear that they had fired their weapons many times, 14 times. We'll just break it down to the most common denominator, 7 times for each officer. They fired 7 times, they hit him twice, and yet the lead officer was no less than about 9 feet behind him.
Cool.
The other officer was probably more like 15 feet or thereabouts, but as I said before, he fired his weapon. When you look at his body camera, in the manner in which he's firing his weapon, he is firing actually over the shoulder of his colleague, which is supposed to be, as we said earlier, that's supposed to be a no-no. But, hey, folks seem to be satisfied with it, and everybody just kind of wrote it off and said
this is M again. I guess I do have a follow-up, question for you, Mr. Edwards. I mean, so does the Blevins, Moore family, do they have any recourse? I know in a lot of these cases, they go into civil actions and
they have a right to file a civil action.
So
they also did have the right to ask the FBI, the Department of Justice, but you see, they got blindsided by Judge Thatcher, because that was supposed to be her job. Let me do this for you again. Judge Hatcher, contrary to what everybody who's trying to talk and etc., Judge Hatcher was actually hired and signed a contract with the Moore family on the 27th of June. Okay. See, the media left y'all with the impression that Hatcher showed up at the same time that the county attorney said he did not intend to charge. That is an absolute fallacy. That is an absolute fallacy. I have to say this also on behalf of the chief of police. Arredondo, even though the case had been taken away from him because of a previous agreement of 2015, he met with members of the Blevins family 27th also at the same spot that Mr. Blevins died. On the 29th of June, Chief Arredondo asked the Moore family for a meeting to discuss the circumstances, and Judge Hatcher's associates and others told the family no. The Star Tribune also asked for an interview with the Moore family. See, I think you picked up on it early on that they basically dismissed the Moore family. The only time you saw anything written about the Moore family was that Sunday, the 24th, in front of the first free support precinct, when Thurman Moore Sr., the father of the deceased, and three of his brothers pulled up in front of the station. He got out. They announced that this was the father of the deceased. He appreciates God bless you for being here. They then drove down the street to the Elks Rest, where the half-sister, Miss Willis, repast was being done. Miss Willis had died a week and a half earlier and had been interned, and they were having the repast at the Elks. That would have been on the 24th. See, dates oftentimes, gentlemen, as you know, become extremely important when people get to talking in terms, as was played in this narrative, that this was a clean kill, nothing was wrong, and let's move on. There was a whole lot more to this, gentlemen.
One more
alternative now is a civil lawsuit. They'll have to find a lawyer.
Okay. But I do want to, you know, kind of rehash this issue about, you said something about the chief was taken off the case or.
Yes. Him, because in 2015, the city of Minneapolis capitulated. Now, the chief, the agreement was signed with the city of Minneapolis, the BCA / the state, that all cases involving officer-involved shootings would be turned over to the BCA. Consequently, the chief, once it was turned over to the BCA, the chief has nothing to do with it except any kind of investigation involving the Internal Affairs Unit, but only having to do with disciplinary action relevant to departmental violation.
That's very interesting. You know, I mean, he's the chief, okay?
Yeah.
And to me, that's a statement of authority, especially on a high-profile investigation, police shooting.
I understand what you're saying. But in December of 2015, the Minneapolis City Council, under then Mayor Betsy Hodgson, signed an agreement that all matters pertaining to officer-involved shootings in the city of Minneapolis would be turned over to the BCA. Takes the chief and the department out of the equivocation. Yeah.
Boy, this script, you know, just keeps being played over and over. You know, it reminds me of something, you know, it's not related to this, but in a way it is because it's in the legal arena. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mr. Edward Jewell, remember when, you know, the great heavyweight champion, to me, the greatest heavyweight champion, Muhammad Ali, refused to go to Vietnam on religious grounds.
Mm-hmm.
He had sound religious grounds. And so what people don't realize is they were getting ready to send him to prison because of that.
Yes.
They had the votes to send him to prison, and they made the chief justice. They made the justice. You know who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Recuse himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, whoever the chief justice at that time of the United States Supreme Court. Yeah. The United States Supreme Court refused
Thurgood Marshall,
to uphold
and they refused to let Thurgood Marshall vote. They made him recuse because apparently he had been involved in another case with Ali. So they thought they said he
conflict
was biased.
Of they tried to conflict of interest, yeah.
So he didn't have a vote. So they were getting ready to send him to prison, except for one judge decided it wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name.
Well, it was that judge who the Supreme Court was hearing when the Supreme Court overturned it, and Ali was not sent to prison. Yeah.
He was not sent to prison. Right.
Yeah,
but I'm
he
just
was
saying,
on his way to prison. Yeah.
I make a point to say that they can continue to change the rules, you know, when it comes time to push comes to shove, and we're always left out.
Absolutely, and you're going to see the same thing happen in St. Paul with regards to the shooting death of the Native American. That's just basically. Now, I was a little surprised because actually Chief Axel at that time kind of overstepped himself. He issued a statement which is in this morning's edition of the St. Paul Pioneer Press. He's actually limited to what he says. He needs to be careful because if the DCA gets ticked off, you know, they could criticize him and say that he cost a impartial ruling and created bias. The mayor even technically has to be careful, though. I think that Mayor Melvin Carter is taking a lead from the mayor over here who got sucker punched. I said that to y'all 3 weeks ago when Mike Freeman pulled a fast one on him and said, you can release everything after I get through investigating and interrogating all the witnesses, and then indicated that 39 police officers alone would be called in. He only brought in 29. But then he told all of us on the day after the decision had been made that allegedly the DCA had already finished their case and he had already made a decision 5 or 6 days earlier. I mean, it was fascinating because he was actually trying to put himself ahead of the private video that was acquired by KSTP for some sum of money from a private homeowner whose camera on the side of his house that video came from. It's just fascinating me, gentlemen, at the absence of clarity in this city with regards to the real events. You know, that the mayor and all of them talk as if the video of that Thursday never existed, but it does. It did. And it gave a clear indication of just how bad things were. But, you know, they sent their video to a different KSTP did, they sent theirs to a forensic laboratory in Cincinnati, Ohio. But the DCA's went to one of the best forensic, quote-unquote, entities in the United States. Operates right there in Hollywood. Got all of the major forensic special effects and et cetera with every major studio in California, in Hollywood.
Well, it's like watching a movie. It's like the special effects. I mean, when I watch it and watch the jumping around, I just don't think it has any credibility. I mean, have you seen the actual unfiltered tape, Mr. Edwards?
No one has except KSTP.
Okay.
Because the BCA was actually talking about how they were going to subpoena that, but they weren't ready to go to battle with the Hubbard Empire, gentlemen. I mean, you know, but it didn't make any difference.
No, not at all.
The county attorney used that, and at the point that the two families lost their legal representation, the courts understood what was happening because there is a mechanism where the decision, we talked about this a couple years ago, gentlemen, where the decision of the county attorney, the local prosecutor, can't challenge before the state Supreme Court, but we don't, you know, you've been saying it in the last 20, 30 minutes, Tim, you know, we don't have that kind of legal representation.
Yeah.
Go take a look at your constitution.
And we do, gentlemen, we do have another caller. I just want to let you know we have someone
go ahead,
for a while.
Oh, go ahead, get the call in, man. Yeah, okay.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead. Hello.
Well, I was listening to your conversation. that's going on in Memphis. I'm sure Minnesota. You know, in Chicago, they had 70 people shot and another 14
yeah,
killed.
11 people died. Mm-hmm. Is it 14 now? Okay.
Mm-hmm. 14 people died.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. 70 plus 14, 84 casualties. I'm sure
mm-hmm.
you guys not having that type of incident up there.
Well, we're not the size
the,
of Chicago, but let me say this to you, sir. Proportionally, when you talk in terms of both population and population of African Americans, percentage-wise, we're right up there with Chicago.
Yeah. And another thing, the court decision on Ali's case was 8-0.
Yeah, it makes you wonder where that ninth body went, huh?
Well, no, Thurgood Marshall had to recuse himself.
Yeah, why?
We discussed that. One of our callers here locally indicated, yeah. Yeah, that's why it was 8-0.
In Ali's case,
the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, by the way, you can have as many members on the Supreme Court as you want to. There's no set number. But Ali's case had to do with
well,
the fact that...
Well, it's only been 200 years. But go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
Ali's case, I think it was less than that at one time, but I'm not sure. But Ali's case was based on his right to declare his religion as
mm-hmm.
an exemption for him going to military service. I had an exemption to the military service during that period of time. Well, not his period, much later,
mm-hmm.
Having to do with occupational deferment. And
mm-hmm.
They do issue, and the court was right. The lower courts had no business. Well, they had no business, but they was doing it wrong when he said he couldn't claim his ministry as a
mm-hmm.
an exemption. So I just want to put that out there.
All right, then. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Em, you were there with regards to your question about Thurgood, which we all knew, but that's why it was 8-0, if you will.
Yeah, but recused. I'm just saying how
He was forced to recuse. Yeah. Don, we have any more calls? We don't want anybody, you know, that been listening because we've been waxing for quite some time. Is anybody else there?
No, we're fine. There's just people in the queue, but we're fine. You know, they're down at the Beyonce concert, Mr. Edwards. I'm looking at social media, and there's so many pictures going on everywhere. I feel like I'm there with them. So it's crazy.
What do we call them nowadays? Selfies? Is that what we call them? Selfies?
Yeah, maybe selfies, you know, and things like, and videos of the stage. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I continue, and as long as we got you here, Em, because you came on it. We're talking about we sent out our condolences to Dr. Joseph Johnson, who was assaulted and beaten by a black African Uber driver. We send out the same thing to the family of the deceased Lakota Native American shot and killed in St. Paul, and we also send it out to John Thompson on the wounding of his son at a funeral at a church in St. Paul, and the police have told Mr. Thompson, the father, that if his son doesn't give him a statement, which would be inadmissible in court because the young man is under significant sedation and etc., that they don't intend to do a thing or raise a finger to investigate the shooting of his son, who is just really hanging on and is, in fact, facing paralysis, if you will. He has a bullet that is actually right there next to his spine. So I just want to do that again, blow that out to the listening audience, if you will, things that are happening in our beloved Shangri-La. This time it's in St. Paul. By the way, I have to say this, with the exception of the minister of the church in question, Danny Gibbon, that none of my leaders, St. Paul and Minneapolis, have gone to the hospital to be and to support John Thompson, who has been called upon to stand tall on both sides of the river, and yet nobody's gone down there to support him in this hour of darkness and this hour of his need. I don't quite understand what's going on, gentlemen. It's too mean-spirited for me. Yeah. Hey, Any questions? Anybody got any questions? We got any kind of calls? I'm just waiting.
Well, I do have a. I would like to make an announcement, if I could, gentlemen. I'm connected with a group of people called the Scott Collection, and Scott Collection is a book on the history of the Minnesota's black community, and it's a compilation. It's out now. And I'm working with the family, and they're doing a new book, Minnesota's Black Community, the 21st Century. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is that on Saturday, August 18th, from 1 to 3, at the Sumner Library, it's 611 Van White Memorial Boulevard. That's right off Olson
Highway. In North Minneapolis, that's right. North
Minneapolis. They will be there Saturday, August 18th, 1 to 3, and Minnesota's Black Community Project will be hosting an open house at the Sumner Library to, you know, raise awareness about the new book project they're putting together entitled Minnesota's Black Community Project, the 21st Century. And we invite professional African Americans in the Twin Cities to be a part of this groundbreaking book project.
Uh-huh.
And so we want people to come to Sumner Saturday, August 18th, 1 to 3. I'll probably try to come on again. And we'll take your picture for the book. You can come to this event. And if you've seen the Scott Collection books, you know what they're about. I mean, what it is basically a pictorial resume of the black community in the Twin Cities.
Uh-huh.
And I ask, why do we need this? Why do you need... Well, and all I can say is, why do we need a Swedish institute? Why do we need a Somali cultural center? Why do we need a Russian cultural center? Why do we need...
Ukrainian cultural center.
Why do we need a Russian? Why do we need... We need it because everyone else needs it. And if we don't toot our own horn, we'll continue to be left out. And so...
Yeah.
I want to encourage the community to come to this event, like I say, Saturday, August 18th, 1 to 3, at the Sumner Library.
This will help support the permanent Gary Sutter collection, which has been at the Sumner Library since its inception almost a decade ago. So this is excellent. It's great to know. I guess, you know, probably people – just got to town, didn't even know that there was a Gary Sutter collection at the Library, which has a lot of artifacts and history and et cetera. But,
I have to really say, I want to really give, you know, as a leader for the Urban League, and I played football against him. You know, I went to Washburn. He was over on the north side with the Smalleys.
He went to North High School. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, a great leader, you know, like Leeson Glover after, you know, and this is what we're missing now. I mean, I do not want to take anything away from the people that are doing their best. They're going to keep the fight going. But I think we've had some leaders in the past that I think if we could draw on their spirit, I mean, I think we could be a little bit farther ahead. And that's, you know, one of the things that the Scott family is doing with their book, and hopefully the community will, you know, want to be a part of it.
Yes, it does. And, looks like now we're getting ready to run over. All right, thank you.
Yeah, well,
got
about a minute left. Thank you.
Okay. Interesting. The Scott Collection will be joining the Gary Sutter Collection at Sumner Library. People probably don't even know that at one point we had a black library, per se. But anyways, what the heck. All right, Mr. Alvin Little, James Brown, take us home, baby. Take us home.
Here we go. Thanks for listening.
Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve.